Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us here on The Mark Steiner Show and on Soundbite, our weekly look at food, the future of our food system, and our environment. Are you listening to Soundbite's Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on DelMarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And reminding you, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on their banner at the top of the page, the Maryland State Education Association. We have a number of things coming up in the course of this hour. We're going to look at issues facing Chesapeake Bay in our state legislature. We're going to be talking about what's happening in the California drought and how it may affect all of us. But we start by looking at what has been the result of this food bill, farming bill, excuse me, that was passed. Maybe you should call it the food bill, and how it affected people who live in large part, their food comes from the ability to get food stamps. We are talking with Rachel Sheffield once again. She's policy analyst in the DeVoe Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael J. Wilson, who is director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. And welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be with you.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at SteinerShow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, but 410-319-8888. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say about all of this. So the food bill was passed, and we talked, I've been looking at my notes from before. We talked over the past year about what would happen in this food bill that that 2 million people will no longer be on the rolls, that that it would save like $11.5 billion over 10 years. But in fact, something very similar to that did happen. That was the only way, one of the only ways the bill could pass. So tell me the effect, Michael J. Wilson, of the food bill on the people that you work with.
So I think one thing that we know for sure is that the $8.6 billion cut in the farm bill is not going to help FSP recipients in the state of Maryland. There is no upside to that other than you could say it could have been worse. The bad news is that this was particularly targeted at a particular program known as Heat and Eat, and only in the Congress in 2014 can you look at the weather that we've had and say that Heat and Eat is something that we shouldn't do for folks on the margin.
So, well, what does that mean in concrete terms and numbers? Can you tell us? I mean, what does that portend?
So, Maryland currently doesn't do Heat and Eat, though we've been having conversations with them about how to do this. But what it means is that states that do the Heat and Eat program, they're going to have a hard time offsetting the high heating bills by letting people have additional SNAP benefits. When CBO scores this, they score this not just on the states that do it, but on the states who might do it. And so the guesstimate that it's $8.6 billion means that states like Maryland won't be able to do Heat and Eat in the near future under the current regulations.
So where's the balance for you in all of this, Rachel Sheffield, between the needs of people who live in real poverty in our country and what the government will and will not do?
Well, you know, I think it's important to understand what exactly this this change made in the Farm Bill did. I mean, it closes a loophole that has allowed states to artificially boost the amount of food stamp benefits that individuals are receiving. The way that the loophole has worked with this Heat and Eat program, individuals who receive Heat and Eat along with food stamps are in some cases eligible for higher food stamp benefits. And so to trigger that higher amount, states have, you know, mailed out LIHEAP benefits for amounts as small as a dollar, simply to trigger that higher benefit for a household. And so what the Farm Bill did was it made it essential that loophole could only, or that could only trigger if An individual's LIHEAP or household's LIHEAP benefits were $20 or rather higher than $20. So it's closing a loophole, basically.
A loophole affecting who, though?
Well, a loophole affecting those who receive both food stamps and LIHEAP benefits. But, I mean, again, it's a loophole where states have, you know, been mailing out checks in the amount as small as $1 to boost food stamp benefits for a household, you know, artificially boost them. And, you know, I think the important thing to remember is that this program should, especially in tight economic times, we want to make sure that resources are going to those who are most in need. And this closes a loophole that has allowed states to artificially boost benefits.
But when we talk about artificially boosting benefits, let me go to Michael and Rachel, come back in. We're talking about artificially boosting benefits for people who have no money or little money.
Exactly right, Mark. I mean, what she's calling a loophole is what some states have done to try to help offset high heating costs and people who are already using SNAP. So it's essentially saying to poor people, yeah, we know that you have high heating costs and we know you're already on food stamps, but we think that this is a loophole for you. And so that's what's happened in years. Once again, the Farm Bill was used to have poor people have to pay more.
Let me see, what does this mean to us? I would just parse this out because there are different points of view here. I mean, the $8.6 billion in cuts, the way I've read it, and please, Rachel, tell me I'm wrong here and what this means, that 850,000 low-income households will see restrictions on their ability to get food. I mean, right, $90 a month on average, and even higher in places like New York City and San Francisco, that will lose these benefits. I mean, and that 85% of food pantries and soup kitchens and food banks saw people, their lines just, you know, just increased. I mean, what do you think the bottom line is here?
Well, I think it's important to put this in context, first of all. I mean, we're talking about a 1% reduction to a program that has quadrupled in size over the last decade, quadrupled in spending, and it isn't simply because of the recession. I mean, certainly, you know, there are more people that are in need of assistance, but I think that's why it's important that we make sure that that food stamps is that we are targeting resources to those most in need. And I mean, the heat and eat, it's a loophole. I mean, states have mailed out checks in very small amounts simply to trigger the higher benefits for households.
But what I mean is, Rachel, I understand all that, but if we get away from just the policy language, we're talking about over 2.5 million. People living in poverty who lose benefits.
Well, I think okay. Well, I mean, first of all, food stamps really there are many more benefits. Food stamps. What Congress really should have done in their reforms was to get food stamps put it on a more prudent course to really help individuals. I mean, if we look at, for example, a work requirement. I mean, currently. The way food stamps is set up is that individuals, even those who are capable of work, they're not required to do any type of work or job search. And so, you know, I think that would have been the most crucial reform to have been made, to put in a work requirement.
But what about those people in that group who are working but have food stamps because they don't have enough money to live on?
Well, then they'd be fulfilling the requirement. They would be working and fulfilling that requirement, and they would be eligible for benefits.
So we can go work for McDonald's for $8 an hour. That would make things better.
Well, but if I can jump in just for a second, I mean, this notion that there are lots of able-bodied people who are getting food stamps and living the life of Riley is a fiction. I mean, as we know, there aren't jobs out there for people. And the reason food stamp usage has gone up is because of the Great Recession, and people don't have jobs. There are 1.3 million people who don't have extended unemployment benefits, and it's not because they don't want jobs, it's because they can't find employment. And food stamps work exactly the way they're supposed to. When the economy is really bad, usage goes up, and when the economy gets better, usage goes down. And for us to pretend that the economy is so much better that people should not be using food stamps is a fiction. And to focus on able-bodied adults only, because those are the ones, I mean, are we including the 5,000 military people who are using SNAP?
So just to respond to that, I mean, yes, I would agree that most people do want to be working. However, there that's what a work requirement would serve as a gatekeeper to ensure that those individuals who maybe could be working but choose not to, because certainly there are those too, and that's why a work requirement serves as a gatekeeper, and it says yes, the help is available if you need it, but in order to receive that, you need to either work, prepare for work, or at least be looking for work in exchange for receiving assistance. It's not a matter of telling people no, this isn't available if you need it, but it's requiring. And again, this is to ensure that resources are going to those most in need. I mean, if we look at work rates among able-bodied adults on food stamps, they're low, even in good economic times. And so I think that's why it's crucial that we, you know, put food stamps on a prudent policy like a work requirement.
Let me open the phone to you real quickly at 410-319-8888. And Leo, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Welcome, Leo.
How you doing? And you're a wonderful guest. I want your guest to briefly address the food stamp program in Maryland, in that in the last year and two and last consecutive cuts in Maryland's food stamp allotment for its citizens. I think, if I'm correct, it's less than $4 per day for people in various categories. I don't see how they can survive on it. And Mark, I'm asking you, of course, about the politics of food stamps in this administration. Why aren't we doing more in the state that's the richest state? We're the richest state in the nation, Maryland. Why are we cutting our food stamp benefits here?
Michael, you want to jump in first?
Sure, I'll jump in first. I mean, the cuts that we've seen have come from the federal level. So on November the 1st, you know, there was a big cut from the stimulus plan, the ERA cuts. And so more than a million people around the country got cuts, and people got in Maryland got a reduction as well. The thing we know about the FSP program, as it's called in Maryland, is called SNAP in other places. In Maryland, it's called the Food Supplement Program, is that when people get benefits, they don't save them, they don't buy investments, they don't go buy yachts. They spend them in local grocery stores, they spend them in local farmers markets. They help to have that money rotate in the local community, and it's been a great boon for our economy that we can do that. And when we cut those benefits, it's not only bad for those families, but it's also bad for our community.
Do you have any thoughts on this, Rachel?
Well, I guess as far as just talking about cuts, I mean, again, I would put it in context. And, you know, when we're talking about, you know, the fact that food stamp spending has quadrupled in the last decade, and I mean, that was even prior to the recession. We saw participation rates increasing. We saw spending increasing. And so, even going forward, even with this 1% reduction, I mean, food stamp spending will remain historically high well into the future. And you know, again, this isn't simply because of the recession, but it's because of policies that have made it easier for people to get on the rolls and to stay there. And so I would just make the case that things like work requirements, that would be an essential reform, just to, you know, ensure that we are, you know, that we are, that the resources are going to those most in need, that we are promoting the best for the individual, that we're encouraging self-sufficiency, we're encouraging them, you know, to be able to use their talents to contribute to society, you know, rather than simply, turning straight to government assistance.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I mean, I think the one thing Rachel and I agree on is that this is a policy that can be impacted. You know, one of the things that helps drive hunger and drives food stamp usage is poverty. And so one of the things we clearly need to do is address the wage gap and address economic inequality. And raising the minimum wage is one of the best things we can do, so that a lot of folks who are on food stamps, who are working part-time looking for full-time work, or who are working more than one part-time job trying to get enough to be able to sustain themselves and their families, can earn more. And so I think Rachel would agree with me that having people be able to earn more by raising the minimum wage is the right policy to address this right now.
But I mean, we have a situation where 144,000 new jobs were created, which is pitiful, in the last month. And even journals that represent the finance industry, like Forbes, talk about if you look at the unemployment rate in America, it's closer like to 14.7% if you look at all the people who stop looking for work and all the other indicators. So where are these jobs people are supposed to find, Rachel?
Well, I think that, you know, again, as I said, even in good economic time, work rates are low among able-bodied food stamp recipients.
That's actually not true.
Oh, well, but it is.
But
if
it's
you look
not.
At the data. No, I mean, no, no.
Most people who will get food stamps work at least part time.
Well, if you look at the rate of able-bodied adults on food stamps who are not working, even in good economic times, that rate remains similar to what it is today. I mean, that's just the data from, the federal government's own data. So,
Rachel, what percentage of those able-bodied adults you're referring to are women with children at home?
I don't have specific details on that, but I know that there is a. If you look at able-bodied adults without dependents, even just looking at that population, rather, the rates of work are low, even in good economic times. So, I mean, just simply looking at that group as well, and I think that's where work requirements should first focus is on encouraging work for those individuals. And again, we know that that the economy is struggling, that jobs are difficult to find, but there are some jobs available, and certainly this work requirement would, it's not that you would have to be employed necessarily, but at least moving in that direction, at least looking for work or preparing for that, the economy will hopefully recover, and it's important for individuals to be, moving in that direction.
I mean, a lot of people have seen me, Michael, who are in poverty are also people who a lot of women and older people are people who have real health issues because they're poor. There are a lot of people who are people who've gone to prison and can't get jobs. I mean, so there's a lot here missing the eye, I think.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't. I mean, again, this is for a population. This is able-bodied adults. I'm not talking about elderly individuals. I'm not talking about those who are not able-bodied. I mean, this is a policy again that would focus on encouraging work for those who are able-bodied on food stamps. That's where this policy would focus, and I think that even though it's not, it's addressing a crucial reform that needs to be made. I think it makes sense that we require individuals to do something, and I think it's best to encourage self-sufficiency.
Michael, a final thought.
Well, I don't know who Rachel speaks to about this. When I talk to food stamp recipients who are not working, they're looking for jobs, and they're looking for jobs any place they can find them. So I think she thinks that there are people who are, as they used to say, on the dole, who are just living the life of Riley. But I think most people would really like to work. In addition, people who are working and working hard and working multiple jobs would like to earn more, and so I think it's really time for us to give America a raise by raising the minimum wage.
Well, I want to thank both of you for agreeing to come on, and it's been a very lively, interesting discussion as usual. Rachel Sheffield is policy analyst at the Indevo Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. Michael J. Wilson is director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. They've joined us before. It's a pleasure to have you both with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back to learn more about the drought in California, how it could affect not just California, but the rest of the nation. Welcome back here to Soundbites, Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. We're about to talk with Andrew Friedman, who is senior climate reporter for Mashable and former senior science writer for Climate Central. And Andrew, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So is it raining out in California?
It has been in the past few days. Well, it has been in Northern California. They actually got one good storm, but it's pretty much their only big event that they've had so far this winter.
So all joking aside, this is a very serious issue because this drought in California has been going on for a number of years. This is kind of we're maybe reaching crisis point now, but this is not a phenomenon that just happened this year.
Yeah, they've been dry for about 3 years now. They were able to get through last year's dry season okay because of a sufficient mountain snowpack that came during January especially. And this year, they just endured their driest calendar year on record. And it looks like unless something big changes, especially for Central and Southern California, and Central California is the big agricultural center of the state, it looks like they're in significant trouble unless something changes.
A couple of questions. I mean, because I think that people like those of us on the East Coast, we don't always appreciate when you go to the supermarket, when you pull off the shelf organic or non-organic lettuce and tomatoes and strawberries, they're coming from California, broccoli.
Yeah, they're a huge agricultural state. In fact, they dwarf any other state in terms of the income generated from their farms. They're ahead of Iowa. They're ahead of Florida, which are both states that we associate with agriculture. California is the number one dairy state, for example, and a lot of farmers are having to sell off their herds of cattle. So many of our agricultural products, so many of our fruits and vegetables come from the central portion of California, the San Joaquin Valley especially, that it's really a big economic issue, not just for the state of California, but for the rest of us, because it's going to affect prices down the road.
How much of this, we know the drought's there. I'm going to come back to the drought and what we think are the underlying historical reasons for the drought. There was some climate change, both those things that people would talk about and get some understanding of that. But how much do you think of this is also based on the 75, 80-year policies, water policies in California that have exacerbated this drought?
Well, I don't know exactly how much the water policies have exacerbated this drought, but the water policies make California probably the most complicated state to have a drought of this magnitude in that I can think of. Florida droughts are complicated enough, but in California, where you have so many thirsty people in dry cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, although it's rained in San Francisco lately, when you have so many agricultural producers competing for water and these huge, massive managed water systems in around Sacramento, it's a recipe for a management disaster. And I think government leaders in California are aware of that and are trying to prevent it. But it's not so much that this drought is the result of those management policies. It's more that those management policies are going to complicate things.
That's what I meant to say. I didn't describe my question very well. And you straightened it out for us all. Thank you. I didn't. But let's talk about the connection between what we understand about the changes in weather historically over periods of thousands of years and where we are now, and how, as you write towards the end of your article, time is running out for California drought relief, that it is probably being exacerbated by climate change as opposed to being just caused by climate change.
Yeah, what we know is, well, one thing that we know about the California climate and the climate of the West is actually pretty scary, which is that in the past, going back by using tree ring records and that sort of paleoclimate records, we know that worse droughts that lasted for a century or more hit California and the West. And if you think about that happening today, it's kind of unthinkable in terms of the impacts that it would produce. So we know that those types of things have happened and have happened due largely to natural reasons, because we weren't around then driving our cars and powering fossil fuel-powered energy plants. Now, though, the difference is that we may be seeing naturally triggered droughts that are exacerbated, that are made worse by global warming, because what you have is higher background temperatures, and that gives you a higher degree of evaporation, which then makes the drought drier, which then in turn makes the drought warmer, which then makes the drought drier. So it's a feedback loop that scientists are looking at, and they're unable to kind of diagnose it in terms of coming out and saying, well, global warming is contributing about 10% to this drought. But they all the people that I talk to, all the senior experts on this topic and on what's going on right now in California, none of them were hesitant to at least say that global warming is playing a role here, just as it did in the Texas drought of 2011, 2012. And in fact, some of that Texas is even still in drought today.
So very quickly, because we have to take a break here, but so you said the next 2 months are critical. What needs to happen? What could happen detrimentally in the next 2 months that you alluded to at the end of your article?
Yeah, well, for example, Northern California just received, some areas received 5 to 10 inches of rain in one big storm that happened over the past week, and some areas received several feet of snow in the mountains. That's a big storm, but they basically need another at least five of those events to hit, and they especially need them to hit in Central and Southern California, and that's not really projected to occur at this point. And their wet season runs until April 1. So that is when the clock runs out. And every day that goes by that they do not get rain or snow or mountain snow is another day lost. It gets us closer to April 1st, which is why water managers in California are so worried.
Well, this is a very serious, and it affects the entire nation. I want to thank you, Andrew Friedman, who's now the senior climate reporter for Mashable, formerly was senior science writer for Climate Central. We're going to link to your writing. It's really well written and really full of things that people need to look at. You can check that out at steinershow.org and see what he's been doing. Andrew Friedman, thank you so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show Sound Bites.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are going to bring it back local. And look at issues facing the state legislature and the Chesapeake Bay and more. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you back here with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and on Soundbites. Always a pleasure to have all of you with us here, reminding you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. www.mecu.com or go to steinershow.org. Click on their banner. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We are now joined by a number of people here, starting with Tim Wheeler, who is a reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. This program in part was inspired, and we'll come back and do more of this in the coming weeks, by an email from Gerald Weingrad, former state senator, attorney, adjunct professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, where he's taught a graduate course in Chesapeake Bay restoration since 1988, about the Chesapeake Bay Agreement that is coming up and many people think is full of holes. And we'll talk about what that means. And Brent Boland's in the studio, Water Coalition Director at the Maryland League of Conservation Voters, which is having their environmental summit tonight in Annapolis. Good to have you all with us. Tim, just very briefly, let me start with you and get an overview from you here. Because what we're seeing with the Chesapeake Bay Agreement, the state of the bay, to me kind of gets all involved in everything that affects the bay, from the rain, what people call the rain tax, quote unquote, the Poultry Fair Share Act, and more, the question of the phosphorus management tool. They all feed into this.
Well, they do, Mark, but I mean, the Bay Agreement is sort of at this 30,000-foot level where all the states that are the six states and the District of Columbia and the federal government are all sort of in, what they call a partnership to try to restore the Bay, and they felt the need to draw up a fresh agreement, since the last one they wrote in 2000 ostensibly expired in 2010. It's been replaced in large part by the total maximum daily load, the TMDL, or commonly known as the pollution diet, in which the Environmental Protection Agency, the federal government, sort of handed out pollution reduction targets to all the states, and those have sort of been guiding a lot of the cleanup efforts. But the states and the federal government felt that they needed to sort of, that there was more to work on, and that they would draw up this agreement. It's been a long time coming, and there are issues that people have with what they finally came up with.
So, they're redrawing this agreement. And Jerry Weingrad, let me bring you in. So the question, this is where the rubber meets the road, and people are going to have to raise the question of what does it mean to redraw the agreement, and what's the agreement done so far?
Well, we're just about 30 years and 2 months past the first agreement signed in 1983, and we are failing to meet our goals to restore the bay. It's quite obvious. We have infectious diseases. Two people I'm dealing with almost killed them from just because they were in the water around Anne Arundel County,
right,
in the
right.
South River. We see bay grasses reach one of their lowest levels since the 1980s, and we see a decline in many of our fisheries, including rockfish with toxic lesions, and our oyster fishery is still in collapse, soft clams, shad fishery. And so, unfortunately, the voluntary effort has not worked, and we need mandatory measures, which is the new pollution diet by EPA, and even some of the states are resisting that.
What's your take at LCV and your take on this?
Well, the time is definitely here to move things forward, and we're very pleased with the pollution diet and where that is going. I personally am doing a lot of work with the General Assembly and the polluted runoff law to protect that, because, the only major source of bay pollution that's still increasing is urban runoff. And in 2012, the General Assembly stepped up to do something about it, and now there's some nervous politics in an election year. And it's a really important step in keeping the bay moving forward, because we need all the sectors lifting. And I think that is what the Bay Agreement is about, is trying to get all of the states pulling, including the headwater states, towards these common goals.
Now, and I know that, Tim, you're only here for a little bit of time, but I want to come back to you just as a political analysis, as a reporter, looking at the state legislature. It just seems to me that no matter what we're talking about, whether it is dealing with stormwater runoff or whether we're dealing with implementing the phosphorus management tool, to me, they're all connected in many ways. And the battle now over whether the Shale Poultry Act makes any sense, and that battle we'll be talking about here next week. But it's whatever it is, the battle to clean up the bay and to kind of monitor things is always fraught with so many issues that we inch along rather than kind of speed down the highway to restoring the bay. Or am I being overly dramatic, Tim?
Well, it's, when you look at the long view, as Gerald does, and I have been following this not quite as long as he has, you see, in order to make any progress, that compromises have to be made, or it seems the compromises are made, one or the other. The people making the compromises think they had to be made. And in doing that, the progress toward the goal is perhaps not as good as it could have been. That's certainly been true of past legislation that was adopted to move the bay cleanup along. And there are compromises that have been made in the current setup. There is pushback now on the pollution diet and on many of the measures that Maryland has, the O'Malley administration and the legislature have adopted to try to advance that pollution diet. You mentioned the phosphorus management tool. That's been it's a regulation, in essence, that the Department of Agriculture was going to adopt to require tighter scrutiny and limits on how much chicken poultry litter could be applied as fertilizer. The farmers have raised a stink, pardon the expression, about it, and said it would cost them a lot of money, could drive them out of business, and the department has pulled it back twice to reexamine it. They say they're going to go at it again this year. You see pushback in the legislature. Brent mentioned that before on the stormwater fees. So far, none of those measures has made it out of committee. There are still others and a few have already been killed in committee. There are still others pending. So that, I guess, still remains to be seen if there'll be any backstepping there.
So I appreciate your being with us. I know you have to run and finish reporting, and we look forward to getting you back a little bit longer next time.
Sure, no problem.
Always good to have you with us.
Take care.
And a reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun Environmental Blog. But, for years, Jerry, you were a state senator. And part of the art of kind of working in a legislature is you often have to compromise with things you don't agree with. To get anything through. So can you talk a little bit about that process and how it's affecting where we are now and what that means to you and how you even address that?
Well, it really isn't so much as compromising right now. The sides have become so splintered and so fractured with the advent of the Tea Party and almost a know-nothingness that folks resist just ab initio, just from the start, without the regards to merits. Any initiative that means spending more money for the Bay or even worse, not going forward with the needed regulation. The only way we're ever going to turn the Bay's decline around is if we have better regulation, including of the major source of agriculture and stormwater. So the legislature, in its compromise, passed an inadequate stormwater management law that only requires 10 counties, which I agree is unfair, even though they're the most urbanized counties, and it doesn't even set a statewide fee. It leaves it up to
right.
each county, so one county put a one-cent thing. It's
right.
not just a compromise. It's a crippling type of piece of legislation that just should have covered the entire state, and it should have required a uniform standard for impervious surfaces that would have gone into a fund, and then the state would dictate that the counties have to meet their limits on pollution, which they have by implementing these stormwater controls. So it's beyond just a compromise. What we see now is that both the environmental community and the legislative folks, and especially Governor O'Malley, are very, very soft on agriculture. And we don't have any real pending other than the nickel chicken tax, which Governor O'Malley has said he would veto, and the sponsors trying to pull the bill back, really making agriculture toe the line. And this is critical for listeners, that it's easy to beat up on developers and polluted areas and urban development, but the biggest source of pollution, this is unequivocal, it's written in stone under all the EPA data, is agriculture. It's 59% of the excess sediment that smothers the Bay's bottom and kills off oyster bars. That's 3.5 times the amount from all the polluted stormwater runoff. For phosphorus, it's the same thing, 59%, 3.5 times the stormwater runoff, and it's 44% of the nitrogen. That's about 3 times the amount from polluted stormwater. What gets the attention? Polluted stormwater. And as long as you're not setting the agenda correctly in dealing with agriculture, as well as stormwater, as well as sewage, as well as septic tanks, you're not going to solve the problem. That's what's so frustrating.
Now, Brent, jump in, because your group really pushed the stormwater tax.
Yeah, that's right. That law was pushed by the environmental community for a number of years, and obviously it changed over time, as you said, going through the legislative process. And, in the end, there's logic to the compromise that was made with tying it to the 10 most populous counties, because those are it's Baltimore City and the 9 largest counties. And those counties have what's called a Phase 1 Clean Water Act MS4 permit from the MDE through EPA, right? So these 10 jurisdictions have requirements, legal requirements under those permits, to do a certain amount of stormwater retrofitting. And what we saw was that there wasn't anywhere near the level of funding that was needed to do that work. And so to help those jurisdictions meet their obligations, which would in turn help them meet their pollution diet obligations, that's why this law was crafted in the way that it was. The issue of local control and the way that the things kind of shook out on the fees, I think that it was really important from the different counties that were, for this, against this, somewhere in the middle, that they be able to have the determination to do it. And I think that the majority of the jurisdictions, thoughtfully engaged this and did the right thing. And so, one or two made a political statement, and now they're engaged with MDE to discuss whether they're really in compliance with the law. I think that that's a whole other issue.
But what I'm wondering here, Jerry, and especially politically, as you've been involved in this so intimately over the years, and I remember it literally. Remember when you and I first met in 1983, or it was 82, when you were running for office there, and then this was your passion from the very beginning when you ran for the Senate. There seems to be. I'm trying to describe just what this line is. Do you think we have between the forces that kind of resist putting a strong Chesapeake Bay Agreement together that actually can do something to clean the bay, and people who really on the other side are also kind of divided over how hard to push and what exactly we need. I mean, that when you were talking about the fracturing, but I mean, this is we're at a critical stage, it seems to me, when it comes to the health of our water and the health of our land.
Well, it's very disappointing and very frustrating. Folks that have been at this for 30 and 40 years and under our senior Bay Scientists and Policymakers group, we have former U.S. Senator Tidings. He's frustrated. The man's 86 years old. Senator Fowler, the champion of the Patuxent River, and many of the Ph.D. scientists, both agriculture and water quality scientists. It is extremely frustrating. We know what we need to do. It's clear we have the blueprint. If there's any body of water in this United States or in the world that's been studied, and we know the sources of pollution, we know how much they cost to reduce, we're just not doing it because the political will isn't there. The environmental community, unfortunately, hasn't been able to become the force that I thought they would. We were on the road when I got out of office in January 1995 to being a very effective political force. Regards to electoral politics as well as influence in the General Assembly. That influence has faded, and the Tea Party is in the ascendancy, and folks are moving to much more conservative politics regarding the Chesapeake Bay. It doesn't have the cachet that it once did, unfortunately, even though all the signs are that the bay is still a troubled body of water, and most of the 75% or more of the bay's waters don't even meet Clean Water Act standards 30 years after the first agreement.
30 years.
Yeah, it's pathetic,
30 years.
Actually. I mean, I have people, when you look at people and you see their legs being eaten up by infectious diseases they got from merely fishing or going for a swim in the water, it's enough to make you sick to your stomach. These are folks that I know. These are not made-up stories. It's happening to us. It's a nightmare scenario. I'll just give you one example. This is a thing that's been reported on by Tim Wheeler and written on by Renee Steinzer of the University of Maryland Law School and their Center for Progressive Politics. And she and he, Tim, just recently, the end of last year, pointed out that the largest chicken operations and other manure-producing operations are animal operations, mainly chicken farms. They weeded that down under the Clean Water Act, being forced by the federal government to have to issue permits to about 540 of these largest concentrated animal feeding operations known as CAFOs. These are industrial-style chicken farms mostly, where they're raising over 1 million chickens on one farm in a year. The law stated that they had to collect these minimal fees. They weren't that much, a few hundred dollars here, larger farms maybe a little more. And the fees were supposed to be collected beginning in 2010, and the permits were supposed to be issued where they have to have minimization of the nutrients and throwing the manure out so that to reduce the nutrients on nutrient management plants. So when you check on this, and the state doesn't publish this, private enterprises have to do this, or like the Renee Steinzer's group, they go out and they look, and they find out that MDE has deliberately waived all fees over all of these years, $400,000 in 2013 alone. That's over $1 million in fees that would have gone to processing these permits, inspecting, enforcing, and really cracking down on one of the most cost-effective, if not the most cost-effective thing to do. That's all this excess manure polluting the bay. 650 million pounds of chicken manure are produced in Maryland alone. So what happens when they check 30% of those 540 major pollution sources in the bay have not gotten their permits over 3 years after the law was, the regulation went into effect in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And the excuse, the major excuse is, we don't have enough staff. Well, $1 million could have hired a lot of staff. And what do you think the response by the department is? we're doing a good job, everything's fine, we're getting there, and nothing really happens. There's no bill in the legislature, CBF, or no one else in the environmental community is suing the department to make them comply with the law. How would you like to have your motor vehicle registration fees waived each year? You know, your permit fees for your registering your car, a couple hundred dollars every
year. Save me some money?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I know, Brent, let me let you jump in on this. I have a tweet coming in I want you all to respond to as well.
Absolutely. So I was actually just at a meeting, a coalition meeting, with the same folks that Senator Weingrad just mentioned, talking about this very issue. And, you know, we are making plans on what to do about this situation. And MDE is actually on record as saying that, you know, later this year when, you know, a new permit cycle starts is when they sort of expect to implement these fees. And I'm not entirely sure what the actual connection between those two things is, but they've said that. And so we intend to hold them to that. And, you know, we've been working. There's no doubt that the agricultural lobby is strong, but we've been working hard in the environmental community to come together in a new way to deal with this. And I think that we're seeing some things that are starting to change, some of the conversation around the phosphorus management tool. You know, I think that that's not going to change overnight, but I think that, you know, we're working together to come up with a new way to engage on these issues and move it forward. So there's no doubt work needs to be done, but we're trying to get there.
Before we come back here to Jerry, let me read this tweet that came in from Dan Yuld, who wrote, will you be able to touch on the 21 attorney generals suing to stop the cleanup of the Chesapeake, as reported in Daily Costs? And he sent the story along with it. Jerry?
Well, it's absolutely absurd, but what it shows is how virulently anti-environmental the farm lobby is. In my 40-some years of public policy, you know, I graduated from the University of Maryland Law School in 1969 and went to work not with a corporation, not with a big law firm, but for the National Wildlife Federation. And during those 44 years in public advocacy as an elected official with NGOs and working as a conservationist, I have never run into a more virulently anti-environmental group or lobby than the farm interest, agribusiness, the Fertilizer Institute, the poultry industry, the farm bureaus. And the farm bureaus are the one that had so much clout in these states to get 21 attorney generals to interfere with a pollution diet that's been well underway, that's mandated under the Clean Water Act, to try to upset that whole process. If the Farm Bureau had its way, and it's tried, it would block any funding for the implementation of the TMDL. The House of Representatives passed such a measure. And so my commentary is what is the blowback from the environmental community other than gnashing the teeth and saying this is nasty? There's no major legislation other than the 5-cent chicken tax, which the governor has already said he's going to veto if it's passed. There's no progress. There's no legislation to move the ball forward, regardless of how strong the lobby is. We're playing defense trying to defend a weak stormwater management bill, not focusing on the biggest source of pollution and the most cost-effective reduce. Stormwater runoff is the most expensive to reduce. It doesn't mean you don't need to do it. Our county's waters, Baltimore City's waters, urban areas are dominated by the stormwater, but overall, agriculture is the biggest source of pollution. You can't give ag a free ride and keep pouring money into the voluntary programs. My final point, in 1982, a subcommittee, when I was a cub in the House of Delegates, we developed the Maryland Stormwater Management Law, the original one, working with the Hughes administration. We got that enacted against all odds. We also created the Maryland Agriculture Cost Share Program. Instead of mandatory controls, we went soft in 82 and got a bill enacted that has given farmers over $110 million of state money to implement best management practices, whether in chicken farms or et cetera. And so that money plus federal money has given farmers in Maryland well over $1 billion in subsidies. It's time to force the agriculture community to stop their pollution.
So, Brent, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you know, the interesting thing about the original Farm Bureau lawsuit on the Chesapeake Bay pollution diet, I mean, the ruling that came out on that was about as big a win as you could have seen for the concept of the pollution diet and for EPA's authority to do that. So, the position that we've taken is that, you know, we need to move forward. It's never ceases to amaze me the effort and money that is expended on avoiding compliance You know, don't they have somebody to run the numbers and figure out it would just be cheaper to do it instead of just fighting this stuff all the time? And so I think seeing, you know, lawsuits get appealed, that's not a big surprise. You know, seeing all the states elsewhere in the country that jumped on this, I think does indicate that there is a lot of promise in this pollution diet if we, you know, keep it moving forward. So,
well, I mean, part of what I read about these attorneys generals, just put it out there very clearly, is that they oppose this, not that they care about Chesapeake Bay. They oppose it because if there's a strong Chesapeake Bay agreement that really puts on restrictions to save the bay and the land and the water, then they don't – this is fueled by business leaders who do not want to have a similar thing dealing with the Gulf of Mexico and the Mississippi and other parts of the West that is the second kind of maybe largest area that they have to address. And so they are saying, well, if this passes, then we're going to have to do the same thing here. We don't want to allow it to happen.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
So I mean, I think that I think the urgency of this, Jerry, is what you've been trying to tell folks for a while, and I think that it's something that, you know, we're looking forward to having this kind of a Chesapeake Bay summit with the governor to really kind of raise these issues. He said he would do one with us, so we're going to try to get that booked. And Jerry, we have like a minute and a half left. Let me get a closing thought from both of you. Literally a minute and a half left.
Well, the Chesapeake Bay program and the Chesapeake Bay restoration, I believe, is stalled. People can tout the PMDL, the pollution diet, but jurisdictions, just look at the Bay Agreement. It's almost a joke, the new one they propose. It's going to the least common denominator. And, you know, this failure to enforce and comply with the law, we passed the Stormwater Management Law in 1982. I'm bitterly disappointed. I read an article in The Sun documenting on January 3rd, not ancient history, of this year, that the Maryland Department of Environment has failed to enforce the law that says they're supposed to check on the ground the stormwater management law implementations in all the jurisdictions in the state of Maryland, the counties and the municipalities. They failed to do that. Some of the counties haven't been inspected since the early 1990s, and they blow this off. Plus, they're granting waivers to the new environmental site design for better stormwater management. They document this in the article. It is really atrocious how far we have degraded the Chesapeake Bay, and how far we have to go with this political fecklessness.
So we have 30 seconds, just about, I'm sorry.
Sure. No, I think that we here in Maryland have the most to gain from a cleaned and restored Chesapeake Bay, and we need to take ownership of that and move it forward. And that's not just the environmental community or concerned policymakers. That's everybody. We all have something to gain from this. And I think that's the bottom line is, you know, at times progress is incremental and slow, but there are things that are moving forward and we need to hold on to those gains, like what we're seeing with polluted runoff and other things and the conversation around the phosphorus management tool.
Brent Boland is Water Coalition Director at the Maryland League of Conservation Voters. Senator Jerry Weingrad, a former state senator, is one of the leaders in putting the Chesapeake Bay Agreement in place in the first place 30 years ago, and is still deeply involved in this. I want to thank both of you for being here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. It's great to have you with us, and we'll have you both back. Jerry, thank you for being out there and swinging on this and never stopping.
Hey, Mark, one quick thing. Brent's one of my former graduate students, took my Chesapeake Bay course.
There you go.
I was waiting for you to bring that up.
I mean, I promise that wasn't a setup. We learned about this after the fact. We'd have them on anyway together. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you
so much. Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Henry and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Delmarva Public Radio is Christopher Rank. Our interns are Matt Malice and Alex Boston. To hear this show again, podcast our past shows, find out information about our guests and the work that they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.